Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And man, I had a blast today on this week's episode. I was joined by Edward Wimmer IV, who is the founder, co-founder of Road ID. Road ID is a company that creates bracelets and identification for adventurers, for people out and about, for animals, so that if you get lost, if you get hurt, people have, you know, it's easy to find the important information for you about any medical conditions, about how to contact loved ones, et cetera. Man, Edward is just a fun guy, as you find. We laugh a lot in this episode. Always have appreciated his outlook and kind of demeanor towards life. But he's built such an impressive business. And as we get into it, I feel like it's really the archetype e-com business. If you want to build something to stay in the game for a while, something that can provide a lot of financial rewards, passion rewards, kind of fulfillment rewards, doing it the right way, not having to necessarily stay awake at night, fearful that the meta is going to cut you off. I won't spoil too much of it here, but I feel like he's just what he has put together and what he has built with his team over there. I can think of a few businesses that I think have built as strong of a foundation and have provided to the owners as exceptional of a journey financially and otherwise than this business has. So anyway, we get into that. We talk a lot about the early origin story because it's really fascinating. It's kind of a little bit scary, a near-death experience. For him, we talk about some of the media that he's done. He's a big fan of word of mouth marketing and product and creating a great experience. We talk about EOS, hiring an integrator, and a bunch of other stuff too. There's a little bit of bike banter and you don't have to be a biker to enjoy it. A little bit sprinkled in there as well. Anyway, had a ton of fun on this one and hope you enjoy it. Before we dive in, every year we survey members of the Ecom Fuel private community, our group of seven and eight figure store owners. And we ask them everything. What do your revenues look like? Margins, traffic, operations, AI impact, hiring, all of it. This year, 300 store owners representing $3.5 billion in combined revenue weighed in. And the picture looks pretty different than it did a year ago. Some of what we found was surprising. Some of it was kind of alarming. And all of it will change how you think about building an e-commerce business today. The Trends Report is free. Go grab it at ecommercefuel.com/blueprint. If you'd like to learn more. All right, let's get into it. Edward, I already mentioned this at the top, but I think you get the nominee, man, for awesomest name and awesomest hair in all of ECF. If not the top, one of the top three or four. I'm excited to geek out about this, man. I was doing the research, fellow biking geek. Got to ask you, you've got a picture. I think it was you. Did you do the Leadville 100?
Yeah, just last year in August.
Dude, talk about that. Because if people don't know, Leadville was actually in Leadville last week. It's at 10,000 feet. This bike race is 100 miles. If you do it in a certain amount of time, they give you this beast of a buckle, of a massive buckle. It's probably one of the hardest bike races in the world. Dude, that's really cool. You did it. And you got the buckle. So you finished in time.
Yeah. So it's, you mentioned it, Leadville, I believe is the highest elevation town in the United States. So when you show up in Leadville, you're at 10,000 feet of elevation. And so you're already oxygen deprived at that. And then, so when you get there for the bike race, you've got a 105 mile mountain bike race ahead of you. And that has a total of 12,000 feet of elevation change just in the bike race alone. And I think you top out around 12,500 feet of total elevation during the course. But like you said, if you get under the 9-hour mark, you get this giant belt buckle that you get to own and wear proudly for the rest of your life. If you finish in 9 hours and 1 second, they give you this tiny little belt buckle.
Pacifier.
Like a pacifier belt buckle that pales in comparison to the big dog. So like 9 hours at Leadville is kind of one of those things in the mountain biking world that is like, that's a marker. Not unlike qualifying for Boston is in the running world. It's a thing that if you can complete Leadville under 9 hours, it's a pretty big deal. So I worked my butt off last year to be able to get to that start line. A lot has to go right. Like you have to dedicate a lot of training time. You got to have no mechanicals issues on the day of the race. You've got to be able to cope with altitude and not get sick and have all your nutrition dialed in. And if all that goes right, you've got a chance of hitting the goal. And I was fortunate and blessed that you know, I had a lot, I had a big support crew at home and through some bike buddies of mine, and was able to put in the training, and a lot went right on race day to accomplish that goal.
Dude, congrats. And also, why have we not seen this at an ECF event? Next time, you got to roll into our next event with one of these buckles, man. Get a pair of Chizos boots or something. And like, I want to see this thing.
Yeah, I did do the full outfit afterwards. I had to buy a cowboy hat, bootcut jeans, a pair of cowboy boots. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
That's cool. Congrats. What was your time? Just out of curiosity.
8 hours and 45 minutes.
Oh, nice. So
15 minutes under the wire.
That's awesome. So that last 2 hours, you were motivated to truck it in.
Yeah. I mean, for people that know the course, there's a big climb with about an hour and a half to go called Powerline. And I was completely depleted at that point. Was not able to take on additional hydration or nutrition. Somehow managed to get up to the top of that climb. And there was a person, a fan spectator, handing out a Coca-Cola over the roadway. And I assume it wasn't for me.
But I was desperate.
I took the Coke and I was like, man, I hope if this was for somebody else, they got another one. But I took the Coke, and like, I don't drink Coke, but like that Coke was a lifesaver at that moment. And so that last 2 hours, hour and a half to 2 hours was pretty brutal. Couldn't take on any liquids besides that Coke.
There's some guy listening right now who was, or gal or whoever, 9 hours, 3 minutes. And they're like, that was my Coke. That was my belt buckle.
Right.
Oh, I love it. So transitioning from one biking to the next one, I promise people listening, we're not going to talk about biking the entire time. But your story, the origin story of Road ID is super cool. I was watching your video, which we're going to talk about in a minute as well. Give people a sense of like, I teed Road ID up at the very beginning, so people have a sense of the product what it's for, but can you talk about, and I don't usually get into the origin story for most businesses because I think they're always not always that important, but I think yours is pretty fitting.
Yeah. So you got to go all the way back. Like I'm an e-com dinosaur. So Road ID started in 1999. And so it was that year I was training for a marathon, my senior year of college, training for a marathon, and I was nearly killed by a pickup truck, run off the road by a pickup truck. And the interesting thing about the origin story is that happened on a Saturday. Prior Wednesday, I had a phone call with my dad, and I was telling him about how I was training for this marathon. And he was like, "Mara, what?" And
I'm like, "Yeah, give me some of that
marathon, Dad." I had to explain, you know, 26.2 miles and all the long runs on the weekends and the training programs and all that. And dad on that Wednesday phone call had a pretty immediate concern, and which was like, what if something happens to you while you're out there training? How will I, as your dad, be notified? And I'm 21 at the time, and you know what a 21-year-old brain is like. So invincible. And I just dismissed dad's concern right up until I was standing on the ditch on the side of the road. And I like to say, and from that ditch, I had two very scary realizations. The first was I could have been clobbered. I could have been killed by that car. I could have been fighting for my life in a local hospital, unconscious and without ID. Nobody would know who I was, who to call, or how to access medical information at a time when you would want somebody by your side more than ever. When you went loved ones and friends there, like I would literally be a John Doe, and that freaked me out. But I also like to say the humorous side, a far scarier realization in that ditch was that for the first time in 21 years that I had to admit my dad might actually be right about something. So
worse, you know, than death.
Right. So it was literally 4 months later, my dad and I started the company in his basement. We were both broke. I happened to have two credit cards that I accessed because I wanted a free t-shirt. Signed credit card apps to get a free t-shirt, and ended up with these two credit cards. They each had a $5,000 limit. So we had two credit cards, a fax machine. And so your younger listeners, we're going to have to Google that and figure out what a fax machine is. And absolutely no clue what we were doing. But we thought that there was a real business opportunity here with this notion of ID that could communicate who you are, who to contact, how to access medical information. And we launched our first online store in the year 2000. The very first night we turned it on, we got 19 orders.
That's great. That is not the story that most people have for their first time.
Well, it's not the story we have either, really, because, you know, as I was dancing around the basement thinking, you know, this is easy, I realized that it wasn't 19 orders. It was one order that had been duplicated 19 times. So first order of business, figured out how to credit a credit card 18 times. That, you know, so while that's a fun story, the serious side of it is that, you know, we were not making any money. My dad and I both had other jobs trying to figure out how to make this thing work. We knew, we believed in what we were doing. We believed that this product could save lives, deliver peace of mind, fuel adventure. But those early days were really hard. Everything changed for us when we got our first, what we call today, our Road ID stories. I'll never forget, we were in a small room in my dad's basement. My dad was, you know, sitting 4 feet away from me when the phone rang for the first time. You know, I answered it, my typical customer service greeting at the time. You know, thank you for calling Road ID. How can I help you? And the guy on the other end of the line said, I'd like to speak with one of the owners. I was one of the owners, but didn't want to let on how small we were at the time. So I kind of put the phone, and I said, give me 1 second, and put the phone aside, and then picked it back up with a, you know, slightly deeper voice on the second answer. There was a guy on the other end of the line named Michael, and Michael was calling to tell us about his son named Brian, who was training for cross country, who was hit by a car while training. And because his son was wearing his Road ID, Michael and his wife were able to get to the hospital in enough time to make some critical care decisions for their son. And, you know, Michael was just going to say thanks. By the time I hung up the phone, you know, I think my dad and I, our lives were changed at that moment, because we knew this thing that we thought was a good idea, we knew we had to see it through. We knew we had to figure this out because it was going to make a difference. And so that story, that phone call from Michael, was our first Road ID story. And here we are all these years later, and it's almost every day we get a story like that. They range in scope from, like, minor incidents where, you know, somebody raises their wrist to communicate what they need to a first responder, to people that say that they're alive today because. And then we have really tragic stories that I have a hard time talking about without getting choked up. But we've had moms post on our Facebook page, you know, pictures of the one I'm thinking about in particular is this woman, Martina, posted a picture of her son on his bike, big smile, this, you know, love note to both her son and to us, sharing with us that because he was wearing a Road ID when he got hit by a car while riding his bike, that she was able to get to the hospital in enough time to hold her son's hand, to tell him she loved him one last time. And so those aren't the stories that you're going to find in our marketing, but they are the stories that keep us really well motivated around here to keep telling the Road ID story.
I think one of the things that didn't expect to come out of kind of the prep for the podcast, but that I thought was so cool, is you have this business that you're running that is not only passion fueled. Like, I think the advantage of running a business today with a passion behind it, I think it used to be somewhat of a liability. I think it's flipped completely 180 to being a huge asset, even though it gets a lot of crap. Not only is that powering it from the biking side, from the training side, from your own story side, but you have this very visceral human mission driven company. And a lot of people say they have mission driven companies. And a lot of them are kind of having to manufacture it, right? And that's not a bad thing, right? Like, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being in business just to make money. That's, you know, unless you do it ethically. But you have generally have this kind of amazing combo of those two, which is God, it's such a cool thing. I imagine that's got to make running a business like you do, the hard parts, that much easier.
Yeah, it really does. I think you and I probably have a similar belief in, like, the types of businesses that you want to own and operate should be the time you want to, the type of businesses that you want to own for a really long time. It may take a long time to grow to get to where you want them to be, but that it's something that you're excited about and passionate about that you're willing to do for a very long time. Seth Godin has this quote that I'll probably butcher a bit, but he says, you better love what you're doing so much that you'd be doing the world a disservice if you didn't do it. And I think you mentioned this. It's, if you have that level of passion about what you're doing, then it makes getting through the hard times a lot easier. It's, you know, your mission or your passion, your purpose is your North Star, can get you through the rough times. Because no matter how good you are as an entrepreneur, no matter how good you are running a business, you are going to have hard times, and something needs to steer you through those.
Yeah, I even thought I have this term, which is going to be annoying for people who listen a lot because I say it a lot, but this idea of the small, durable business, a business that's built over with consistency that has a meaningful word of mouth component that's often passion driven by a founder who's forward facing or at least very involved. And I think those are the businesses that, not that you can't make it other ways, but I think those have a huge strategic advantage going forward for a lot of reasons. And I had to rethink potentially rebranding that in my own mind, because like that, you fit this perfect, you've been doing this for 20 years, fits all those criteria. Word of mouth, as we'll talk about in a minute, is a huge driver of what you do, but you're not small, right? Like you're in the eight figures. So it made me think like, okay, I need to reconsider this, because you don't have to be small. You just have to have the philosophy, and it can compound over decades like it has for you, which is really amazing.
I think I align with everything you said there, especially on the word of mouth side of things. I'm pretty passionate about that piece. One of the ways I think about that is, you know, you ask 20 different people what their definition of brand is, and you get 20 different answers. I think fundamentally, though, you don't have a brand unless people are talking about it. If people aren't talking about you, what you have is a logo. You don't have a brand. And you know, we have this one phrase strategic plan, that, as we call it, which is to deliver a product, service, and journey so blindingly awesome that our customers can't help but share it. That's rooted in two beliefs. One is that there never has been and there never will be a more powerful marketing lever than word of mouth. In our e-commerce community, we tend to really get hung up on this notion of paid media. Meta is the dominant topic of advertising and marketing and acquisition. But fundamentally, there's nothing more powerful than one person relaying to another their experience with a company, a brand, or a product. Full stop. I'll die on that hill. And secondly, it's rooted in this belief that people don't really want to do business with businesses. People want to do business with people. So that founder forward or founder focused approach, delivering high levels of passion, is something that does fit well for us, because of those two core beliefs around word of mouth and acting as a business. And you know, to that end, we try in every touch point. We run digital, all of us, your audience, we run digital businesses, but we believe that there's a fundamental advantage in acting like real people, like humans at every touch point in the customer journey. And I actually contend that it's easier to do that online with a digital business than it is in person, because your number one salesperson, your website, can be really consistent. They don't have bad days or wake up on the wrong side of bed or just, you know, get divorced or break up with their girlfriend. Like that doesn't happen to your website. They can tell the same story day after day after day, and you can hone it over time to be really human.
Yeah. How do you, when you look at your marketing mix, word of mouth, hugely important, paid media, not as powerful, but can be a great tool in the toolbox. What's your split between word of mouth and direct traffic versus paid? How do you think about paid in a way that you still use it and leverage it, but you don't elevate it beyond where you think it deserves to be?
Paid is still very important. It is, you know, Meta still is very much the tip of the spear that starts the customer journey for us and so many other brands. But where the force multiplier is in that customer journey, that word of mouth. I mean, today, you know, if I went into Shopify today, I'd find that half of our customers today on Road ID and Dog ID are going to be returning customers.
Half. That's amazing. Okay. And you're a huge proponent of incredible experience. I mean, you talked about creating experience people can't help but talk about, and a big fan of premium packaging and product. Can you talk a little bit about maybe the packaging, what you try to do there, and any other points in the customer journey that you really try to elevate?
Yeah. So back to the notion of customers wanting to do business with people and not with businesses, the packaging is a really big element of that. So all of us, you know, if you're in my household, you know, I'm going to go home today and I'm going to find, you know, three packages from Amazon that were delivered today and, you know, and one or two from some other brands. And very rarely do any of us open up a package from a company and think for a second, not for one second, about the person that put the order together for us. And I think that's a huge miss. And one that we've tried to address with something we called a fulfillment business card. And so when you get an order from us, you're going to get a business card. It's a 4x6 card in the package, and it's going to be from somebody on our fulfillment team. So I'll use Becky as an example. Becky's a real person. And when you get a package that was put together or assembled by Becky, you're going to learn a little bit about Becky. There's going to be a picture of her on it. It's going to have a couple fun facts, her favorite adult beverage, her first car, her favorite band, her first concert experience, and things like that. Then on the back is a handwritten note. Like, it was handwritten once. It's not handwritten every time, but it was handwritten once and printed that to look like handwriting. And it's going to tell you a little bit about Becky's experience working at Road ID or at Dog ID, why she likes it here, and how happy she is to have the person receiving the order join the family. And on those cards, we even have Becky's email address. So, and we say something cute at the bottom of it, like, if you're impressed with how perfectly packaged your order was, please fire off an email to Becky, and we give her email. And you wouldn't believe the number of people that take the time out of their day to send an email in to Becky to tell her about how awesome it was to receive a note from her. And then some people, and this was never our intent, will actually take the time to answer all the fun fact questions that Becky answered on her card. So my first concert was AC/DC, and you know, my favorite adult beverage is X, and so forth. So it's really fun, and it not only makes the connection between from person to person, person at the company to the customer, but it also gives Becky more buy-in to the work she does on a daily basis.
Her name's on it. Her picture's on it.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the next point I'll make on this is, and I may be stealing this from Taylor Holiday, or maybe Taylor Holiday stole it from me. I can't remember. The notion of your package is the only thing that we do as marketers that gets 100% open rate. Like every package you ship will be opened, and you got to make that count. Fulfillment business card is an example. Another item we put in there is something called a share card, which is usually a $10 off gift card that we give to the customer to tell them, hey, come back and buy something when you need it. And another one that we say, give this to the first person you think about that needs the product you just purchased.
Yeah, I remember when we got ours, I mentioned at the top of the episode, we used ours, all of us used them, but it was especially helpful for kids, like when we were traveling in random big cities and you're like, dude, you lose a kid and 10 million plus person city, it's just nightmare scenario for a parent. And I remember opening them up and being like, dude, the packaging on these is really good. Like I have that distinct memory. You guys are nailing that. Talk a bit about, I love your About Us video. Like, so you go to your website and you got a full-on video, it's probably 3 or 4 minutes, and it goes through the whole story. It's entertaining. So many About Us videos are really boring, shot in boring warehouses. Like yours is fun, it's interesting, it made me laugh multiple times. I'd love to hear a little bit about how long that took to put together. Did you put it together in-house, like the impact it's had? Because it's just such a cool part of your homepage.
I appreciate you saying that. And glad that it made you laugh, because that was the intent. It should make you smile. It should give you a chuckle or two throughout the process, and which is an interesting juxtaposition, because we sell this very serious product, right? Like, that could literally save your life, but we try to do it with inject a lot of personality and wit and humor and whimsy throughout the process. That particular video, the script was really just evolved from the actual founding story. So the script came together pretty quickly, and we did that internally. And then we leveraged a local production team to do the shooting for it. So we had a few different venues where we did the shoot. One of them was actually our office number 2, which was we moved out of Dad's basement eventually into a house. We bought this house. It was a 3-bedroom house, and my office was in one bedroom. My dad was in another bedroom, but that house was vacant at the time we were shooting this video. So we were actually able to go back into that house and shoot part of it there. We went to a local university to film some dorm room content that was, me back in college. So I had to put on a wig that had a ponytail, because I was rocking a ponytail back in the day.
No way. We got to get some original pictures from back then. It was funny. I was watching the video and I was like, is that Edward? It is, with a wig. So yeah.
Yeah. So we had to find a fax machine too to recreate. That's harder to do than you might think. But yeah, our first orders came in on literally on faxes. It's wild to think about that. But it was, if you've you've ever turned on the Shopify cha-ching sound when an order comes through. Getting orders via fax gave you that similar dopamine hit in the back of the day because, you know, the phone actually had to ring. And then you would hear this, you know, silly little thermal printer turning away to send an order your way.
You know you're an OG when in e-com.
Yeah, I can tell you lots of OG, like early e-com stories.
Roughly, what was the budget to put that video together? And has it been, because I've done a similar kind of video that we did that for ECF Live in Bozeman, almost about, yeah, I guess about 9 months ago. I had a lot of fun putting it together. And also, to be fair, I haven't leveraged it and got it out there as much as we should. Still, it was fun. The ROI on the fun factor was great. The ROI on the, like, is this moving the needle factor is still to be determined. For you, what was the budget on it? And do you feel like it's had the impact? Like, has it been worth it?
Well, it made you laugh, so absolutely worth it. Yeah, I don't think we had more than about 10 grand involved in that whole video.
Oh wow. So, okay.
Yeah. I mean, we used our own internal team to, you know, as the talent, quote unquote talent. The production team was local group, pretty small at the time. And, you know, they did a great job doing the shooting and editing of it.
When you look at your product line, so you've got, I would describe your product line as very necessary, hugely important. Your probably average prices, I was looking, you know, probably $25 to $40. So let's say low to medium-ish AOV. How do you think about, and also from a repeat purchase perspective, right? Like people don't need lots of, you know, not lots of them necessarily. How do you make that work from an advertising, from a business perspective? And I'm guessing part of that is why you've built out kind of a family of brands. But talk a little bit about how you make that work and your strategy there.
Low AOV certainly doesn't help. And it's made, on the Rotary side, it's made even harder just due to the nature of the business. Like we have to create demand. We're very much not in the demand capture, especially in the early days. And still today, we're not in a strong demand capture space, even though we've done a bit of category creation, like creating a category and telling people not only that you exist, but trying to explain to them why they need the thing you're selling is a lot harder. And there's definitely been times throughout our history, I thought, man, like we're playing this game on hard mode. Low AOV, got to create the demand and present the product in a way that we can do so profitably at a $40 AOV. So yeah, super challenging. And your question was how do we do that? I mean, we still think about things very much like most of the listeners here do. Like we definitely want to be first order profitable. We understand our contribution margin very well in order to achieve that. And we have tried to create a ruckus in lots of ways outside of paid media over the years, which has helped us build this very big list of purchasers. So, you know, we like to say that we've impacted more than 5 million lives, and that hasn't all happened through paid media. Some of that stuff happened in early days by doing tiny little ads in the back of Runner's World and Bicycling Magazine that eventually became full page ads. Some of that happened because we did large giveaways during the Tour de France. So we shot commercials with professional cyclists, and we ran commercials during the Tour de France. And then we had an integration where we would do give away a $15,000 bicycle, and we would have hundreds of thousands of people sign up for the giveaway. We were buying newsletters back on active.com when, you know, a newsletter to their audience would cost us $50,000 a pop. And we were able to do that profitably. Like you would never spend that kind of money today on something like that. But back then, like your inbox wasn't flooded with crap. So the emails actually got better visibility. You know, we had an event sponsorship program that at one point we were sponsoring 8,000 grassroots running and cycling events.
8,000?
8,000. And part of that sponsorship was we would give you the bib numbers that you would need to wear, that you would safety pin to your shirt, so you need to wear on race day. And so we were able to brand those bib numbers. We put a coupon on those bib numbers that you could tear off and use on our website for free shipping or for a few bucks off. And so we've done a lot outside of traditional performance marketing in order to help tell this story and grow the brand over time. We don't do so much of that anymore, but I think it would be really hard to start today and with Rode ID specifically and have paid media, performance marketing, Meta be the only lever that that we have. I mean, even today, we have a team of elite professional cyclists that are part of the story, and that might be a little atypical for a brand our size.
And with paid, then, are you mostly focusing the paid efforts on retargeting, or are you actually doing top of funnel prospecting for stuff?
Both, and we are. You know, we are still, like everybody, trying to scale our Meta account, but we are disproportionately Google at this point for Road ID, and to a degree for Dog ID as well.
Interesting. I would have guessed the other way, given that you're in a category where a lot of times you have to educate, create demand, and then capture that. I'm guessing fewer people are searching. When I think Google, I mean, obviously they have display in other areas, but I think Google more search-driven. Meta is going to be more just, you know, kind of get stuff in front of people, top of funnel, not necessarily search driven. Why is that the case for your makeup?
Because when you've been around for 25 years and you create a category, organic demand, search demand does, while it was non-existent on day one, it is there today. And then we also perform pretty well on halo audiences as well. So our core audience, runners, cyclists, triathletes, but we also win a lot of searches for medical ID terms. So, and that's something that's been around, that predates us, has been around a really long time. So there's lots of medical ID jewelry sold by lots of different companies. And I don't mind saying that most of it is garbage. And so if your doctor tells you should probably be wearing an ID for a chronic medical issue, you're diabetic, and you go out shopping and you find Road ID in your Google searches, chances are we're gonna convert you there.
Very cool. Talk a little bit, if you would. I'm a finance geek. We got to do a finance section a little bit. Greg Crabtree's simple numbers mode. It seems like you follow some of his guidelines, benchmarks for running your business. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So we do use a simple numbers modified approach to running our forecasting side of the business. Yeah, in terms of how we leverage it, that's actually, you know, I'm still the one doing the forecasting every month. So I've got a simple spreadsheet. Simple number, simple spreadsheet that has, you know, four key things that if I can predict accurately across for the month, I get really close to hitting what our profitability is going to be for that month. So if you can predict, if you have a reasonable prediction of top line revenue, of what your contribution margin is, what your fixed costs are going to be, then you can get real close to predicting your profitability on a month-to-month basis.
I remember also one of the things I took away from his book, it's been a little while, but he talked about just the importance of paying yourself a market salary, right? Like, and it gets less of a big deal when you grow and you've been around for 20 plus years and you've got the scale like you guys do. But especially for small to medium-sized brands, looking at your business profitably, making sure you take a market salary is accurate when so many people look at what the business makes, but they don't account for their time and they get a skewed perspective of that.
That's a change we made quite a long time ago, is that, yeah, I mean, while you can have all the passion in the world for your business, and we certainly do, but it's also not a charity. Entrepreneurship is hard, base level, like it is hard. And you don't really want to do this for too long without making it a fair and equitable outcome for yourself. So otherwise, and somebody sent this to me a long time ago, I was part of in a Vistage group. Somebody articulated it really well for me in a group, and it just made a lot of sense. Like if you're not looking for an appropriate financial outcome, then all you've done for yourself is create a really difficult job. So why, you know, don't just have a difficult job. Certainly there are going to be times in early days, and there are going to be years where you may not be able to compensate yourself the way that you want to, but that's got to be a fundamental part of why you're in this.
Oh yeah. Medium term. Absolutely. You've been a huge fan of EOS too, I believe. It's been instrumental to your business, helped you grow. Can you talk a little bit about what it did for the business? And I'm also especially interested in if you customized it a little bit. Like it's always interesting to hear. Some people are just like, man, we're just super strict, by the book, we don't deviate. Other people, this is kind of more my camp, had some issues with a few parts about it. So we customized and tweaked a few things here and there. But it seems like it's been a really hugely beneficial thing for Road ID.
Yeah, massive, massive fan of EOS. You know, for the people that don't know what it is, it's essentially just a set of systems, processes, and tools that will help you deliver a better outcome for your business. You know, the initial book Traction, highly recommended. If you haven't read Traction, you know, please do that. It was very eye-opening for me. You know, some of the big changes that it made for us, the level 10 meeting, and making sure that every team inside the organization, not only the leadership team, but our customer service team and our ops team and our fulfillment team and our marketing team and our ID team, all those teams are working on a weekly basis to solve the biggest issues in the company on their teams. And that's a really powerful part of EOS. A shared lexicon throughout the organization, so we all use a similar language around the operation of the business. It's added a lot of order to the chaos that can be an organization. So I'm a huge fan of it. And in terms of like, are we hardlined about it or do we customize it a bit? I'd say we're mostly true to the process. One thing that I don't think any e-com EOS company has figured out, and if you haven't figured this out, please let me know because we haven't figured it out, is how to effectively do a EOS scorecard for e-com. We don't have that dialed in. So we've tried a bunch of different iterations and we're trying a new one now. And if it works, I'll be sure to put a post in the forum about that. But so we take a little leniency there. And for a very long time, we didn't have the true visionary integrator duo. So again, we've been around for quite a few years, and only recently did we put a true integrator into the integrator seat. And man, has that been great.
How did you find them? Because I feel like that is the most difficult hire for most companies.
We had a few failed attempts. So we put a few people in that role that didn't work out for one reason or another. It is a very hard role to fill. And most recently, we promoted from within. So we had our head of technology that I kind of identified from very early days of him starting. He was actually an engineer for us for a while, left, and then came back to run our technology team. Small team, but was just, I knew from the first few months of working with him that he was the type of person that could grow into the integrator role. And when I first broached the topic with him, he was like, oh no, I'm not ready for anything like that.
Deal with the humans and the technology? No, thank you. No.
Yes. But then it was, you know, a little over a year after that, he came to me and he said, remember that integrator conversation we had? I said, yeah. And he goes, I think I'm ready to take that on if that's something you're interested in. And so we're down that path now. And it has certainly freed me up to operate more in my unique ability, which happens, you know, one of those things happens to be on the product development side of things. So I've developed more product in the last year than I probably did in the prior 5 years. And I'm able to think at a higher level and just have the brain space to contribute in more meaningful ways. I love the minutia just as much as anybody else. I mean, I'll sit down and crank out a spreadsheet and be real proud of it and happy that I took the time to do it. But my highest value work is thinking more strategically, you know, three-year vision, 5-year picture, VTO type stuff, as well as working on product.
I think I've talked to a lot of people. I actually just talked to someone earlier today who had gone through probably 2 or 3 misfires before they found a director of ops / COO integrator role that worked. When you look back at the 2 or 3 or however many it was that did not take, any lesson or lessons that came out of those where you're like, this was the mistake we made or mistakes we made that people listening might be able to learn from?
One of the misfires, we put somebody in the role that happened to be a lot like I was. So we weren't as complementary as we needed to be. So we were both more visionary than we were integrator, and that was a miss. So the very much liked the person, very much liked some of the stuff that they brought to the table, but we ended up just being too much in the same lanes. And an integrator and a visionary really need to be operating in completely different lanes. And they need to be really, what we found for us at least, is they need to be really process oriented. And I would never have set our team up on, this is a very specific example, but by way of example, I would have never gotten our team aligned around a specific project management solution application software package. a good integrator has no problem saying, this is the tool we're going to use, and this is how we're going to use it, and this is how we're going to standardize around the organization. Open to feedback and input from each team, but this is what we're doing. And I'm just not wired like that. That would have never come from me. And so our integrator was able to put a project management process in place for us in pretty short order. And it's dramatically changed the organization.
You said you've had the chance this last year to do a lot more product development. And one of those products is RackRabbit, which, again, kind of getting back into bike territory, I was looking at that ahead of time. Really cool product. Actually think it solves a need. Talk a little bit about that, where the idea came from, how excited you are to have something that, it's always fun to do your core business, but it's always got to be careful, right? You can definitely like veer off and spend all your time on these, you know, shiny objects. But this one seems like it's also fun too, if you can keep it within the lane. So talk a little bit about RackRabbit.
Yeah. So RackRabbit just went live at the end of the first quarter. We still don't have product. So we've been on pre-sale since the end of first quarter. We're actually going to be able to ship some stuff at the end of this month, but we're not going to be able to ship the stuff that we first put on pre-order. We're going to ship the stuff that we put on pre-order second. So a lot of stress associated with missed deadlines on launching a new brand and new product. But the product itself was born out of my personal frustration as I'll use the term mammal, middle-aged man in Lycra. So my personal frustration as a mammal, I own a lot of bikes.
I have to interrupt. How many bikes? Come clean. How many bikes? Because I get crap from this from my family too. So I'll share if you share.
Currently in my garage, I have two mountain bikes, a gravel bike, a road bike, and an e-bike, a Suron e-bike.
Okay. Yeah, that's not too bad.
But my kid, you know, my oldest son has two bikes. My youngest son has a bike, and then my wife also has a bike. So you put all those together, and it ends up being a pretty crowded garage. And one of my issues. All right, before I move on.
Oh,
how many of you?
I'm the same place as you. I think I have five bikes. I have two mountain bikes, two gravel bikes, and a road bike. So,
there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not egregious. Really, I mean, we probably know people that have 20 bikes of their own.
Yeah. 20 is a lot. You and I can give them a crap. I was hoping one of the two of us would be able to give each other a hard time, but tied, maybe the best outcome. Anyway, sorry.
There you go. As somebody that owns a lot of bikes and rides bikes a lot, like you've got all the gear. You've got your helmet, your glasses, your heart rate monitor, your gloves, your special cycling shoes, your bike computer, your bike lights. And a lot of this stuff needs to be charged on a regular basis. So not the bike per se, but there are batteries on the bike that control shifting that need to be charged. The bike computer needs to be charged. The lights need to be charged. I wanted a rack that not only solved problem number one of being able to rack a nice bikes in a very stable fashion in the garage, but I also wanted it to be the headquarters for all my gear. I wanted to be able to go to the garage and put my helmet on the rack and put my glasses on the rack, put my heart rate monitor on the rack, charge all my tech on the rack. So everything was centrally located. That would enable me to do two things. One, get out the door faster. And two, it would enable me to have a visual checklist. If that rack is empty and all the stuff I took off of it is in the car, then I probably have everything. And I'm not going to show up to the group ride and realize that I forgot something because all my stuff's racked on the rack and it's gone. I must have it. Very closely related to that is product number two, something we call the Ready Bag. Now, the Ready Bag is a duffel bag that is cycling specific, and there are not unlike a camera bag would be for photographers, where you have your lenses and all your different camera gear in specific pockets. This bag is, you know, has a place for your helmet and your water bottles and your shoes and all that, and it's very carefully designed around the gear that a cyclist is going to take with them when they leave home. Whether that to be traveled to a race or go to a local group ride, and all the pockets are labeled. And again, it's not unlike the rack itself, it's a visual checklist. If this bag is full, if all the little compartments inside are full, I have everything I need, and I can head out the door with peace of mind that I'm not going to show up to my ride with something missing.
And how, you know, it's interesting again, we've all, not all of us, many of us running businesses have had side projects pop up. And sometimes it's because we want to make more money on them. Sometimes it's a passion project. Sometimes it's a combination of the two. As someone who has at one point run like three different businesses and it was a struggle, and I look back now, I'm like, how in the, I could feel the energy bleed and pared that down. How do you feel like, you know, it's an amazing product and it scratches your own itch, also takes time away from the main business. Is it at the stage where it's fun, it's kind of interesting, it's been worth it? Are you regretting like diversifying your efforts? Where are you at that kind of, on that spectrum?
Maybe I just like the brain damage of it all. But that's not really true. Like I wouldn't do this. I would not surf this wave if I didn't think we could make it work inside the organizational structure that we have. My belief on that is that, you know, there's several things that I want to, before I would consider launching a new brand, there's several boxes that I want it to check. You know, one is something, I want it to be something I'm personally passionate about. Two, I need it to align to our core values as an organization. Like our core values aren't just at the brand level, they're at the company level. And I wouldn't launch a brand that would somehow steer us outside of those lines. Operationally, like we need to be able to leverage the existing team that we have. So when I say operations, I mean things like customer service and fulfillment and supply chain and things like that. Those existing teams would need to be able to service the new brand. And the brand should be able, in the ideal scenario, is that we'd be able to leverage our existing audience to help launch the brand. So it's a lot harder to start from zero. But this is a brand in the cycling category. And half of my customers at Road ID, and it's a list I've developed over 25 plus years, half of that audience are cyclists, and I can help fuel the launch of the brand through that. Where we will do special things for a brand is really on the marketing side. So right now, our marketing structure for our brands is that we pair a really talented marketing manager with a really talented creator. I mean, it's really a two-person marketing team. And those people don't think about other brands. Those people only think about the brand that they're working on. And so that's where internally with the structure, we diverge a bit. And I think it's the only thing that makes this holdco structure work. So you and I both know people that have done the holdco structure, and some that have said it's the worst thing they've ever done and moved on. And others are still, you know, fighting the good fight. You know, for us, it seems, you know, with Road ID and Dog ID specifically, those are the two brands that have been around a while. The structure has worked well for us, and we think we can layer on this third brand without causing too much internal chaos.
Yeah. Well, you've got, I think the thing that's different between other portcos and you is you have, what kills a lot of the other ones is completely desperate brands. Like we sell sunscreen and then we sell hair growth products and we sell umbrellas, right? Like you have a close enough portfolio, very similar with the products that you're selling, that it seems like a lot of the learnings work, a lot of the personalization in-house. Like there's a lot of things that bleed over and work well. Edward, I love what you're doing, man. Talk, if you would, about Road ID, just for people who are, I want to make sure you mention all of the portfolio companies. RoadID.com is the one we've been talking about the most, but you've got really cool products like an AirTag holder for dogs, dog identification products. Give people a sense of the whole kind of breadth of your offering in case any of them make sense for people listening to go check out and pick up.
Yeah, RoadID.com. We've talked a lot about that, so I don't think I need to share much more, but DogID.com was launched out of RoadID.com. We had a pet product on our store that was mainly geared towards athletes, and it was set on the dark, dusty corners for the better part of a decade, and it was a really good product, and my team on multiple occasions have said, you know, please, you know, can we put marketing effort behind this product? And I would always say, no, we're not a pet company. We're here to save lives, deliver peace of mind, and fuel adventure for humans. That's our core focus, our core purpose, our core passion. We're not promoting the pet product. And then in November of 18, I finally relented and I said, okay, fine, spend some money on the pet product. And that business 30x'd over the next, that part of the business 30x'd over the next 12 months. So much so that we got really excited about it and we started creating a lot more content around it. We shot some commercials, some long format TV commercials also for YouTube as well. you know, we put a man in a dog suit and the man was pretend pooping on front yards and talking about our pet products. And that was all really fun. But it got to the point where, like, if you came to roadid.com and were looking and you were a cyclist looking for our athletic related products, you might think we had completely changed gears. And that was the, you know, I remember sitting down on my computer one day going, like, if I was a cyclist, I don't know that I'd understand this brand anymore. And so that was what led us to peel Dog ID off as its own brand, which has allowed us to allowed us to scale and grow that brand outside of just ID products. So the initial hero product was IDs, but now we make premium collars and leashes and harnesses. We just launched the world's best bowl called the Better Bowl. It's a bowl that is one piece and easier to clean. And because of that, a lot less bacteria gets built up in the bowl, and it's healthier for your dog. The AirTag holder that you mentioned, we have a hero product called the Shitty Kit. That's spelled with a C, S-C-H-I-T-T-Y, Shitty Kit. That was developed around the premise of, like, when I was walking my dog through the neighborhood, I hated picking up their crap and then putting in a little flimsy plastic bag and then carrying that bag for the rest of my walk. Like, you know, the joke I make is that I have my car drives me to work, but I was still walking around with a plastic bag full of poop in my hand. So we've developed a bag. It's a dog walking kit that stows the poop away and seals it in a stink-free double-walled doo-doo chamber, is what we call it, and allows you to carry your phone and your keys and all the other essentials you might need, dog treats, stuff you might need on a dog walk. So product expansion has really been the key to growth on that brand, where Road ID still has this very narrow product category. We've been able to expand on Dog ID. Brand is still smaller than Road ID, but I don't think that's going to be the case for long. So dogid.com is that brand, and then rackrabbit.com, R-A-C-K, rabbit.com is the new brand. If you go to any one of our stores, our highest level navigation is going to point you to the other brands and sub-brands that we have.
I was going to say, you've done a really good job of keeping enough brand identity around each one of those while integrating them. That's a really hard balance to strike, but I think you've done a good job of it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I don't know that, you know, maybe that's a bit of luck.
Well, Edward, dude, always love talking to you and appreciate you being an ECF, like in the forums, but especially at, like, the events I've got to see you at over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, man. You're always upbeat. You're always fun. I love the energy you bring to things. Man, I can't thank you enough for being part of the community. And also, just congrats on building something cool. I feel like what you have done is, not everyone can go back, you know, 20 years and build this, but like the way with which you have built this company with a long-term horizon built around something you care about, making really interesting, unique, differentiated products that impact. Like, I feel like it's the archetype for what a great, successful, durable, long-standing brand should be doing. And just kudos, man. You and your dad and your team have done such a good job with it. So yeah, well done. Congrats. And thanks for being a part of our community, man. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you for all those kind words, but also, and as importantly, for the community that you've built. Probably get sick of me saying this, because I feel like at every event I sing the praises of what you've done. I cannot believe, being the e-com dinosaur that we are, that it took me as long as it took me to find your community. For so many years, I felt like I was doing this e-com thing on my own. And, you know, with your community, I no longer feel that. There's so many people that I could reach out to if I have a question, either in the community directly or relationships that I've formed, that where I now can reach out to somebody via text message or WhatsApp or pick up the phone and give them a call, and always willing to help. And I think what you've built cannot be understated, how valuable it is to e-com business owners and founders like me.
Man, well, thank you, Edward. I appreciate it. And yeah, man, looking forward to the next event, and we'll have to get out a ride some point, man. I don't think we've ever ridden together apart from maybe a Palm Springs e-bike cluster with 20, 25 people. I can't remember if we were on that together or not.
Yeah, real bike ride soon. Maybe I can convince you to be my partner in one of the Epic Series races, and we can go do a 5-day race in Croatia, or an 8-day race in South Africa, or a 5-day race in Andorra.
I'm not sure you want me as a partner, given your Leadville 100 time, but that sounds like a pretty, that would be a difficult offer to turn out. That sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, they're fun events, and you'd be a great partner.
Well, thanks, man. Hey, I appreciate it. Good talking to you, sir. One final thing. 4 in 10 7- and 8-figure store owners have less than 12 months of financial runway. That means a bad tariff surprise, an algorithm change, or one rough quarter could be existential. These aren't startups. These are real businesses that look solid on the surface. The difference between the ones with 4 months of runway and the ones sitting on 9 years of cash cushion on the bank usually comes down to financial fluency. At least that's what our research shows. There's a huge correlation between how well you know your numbers and how much safety cushion you have in the bank. If that makes you a little uncomfortable, the Financial Mastery Series is probably worth your time. It's a free course built for e-com owners that you can grab at ecommercefuel.com/mastery. And if you want a peer group of 7- and 8-figure owners who think about this stuff every day at a high level, make sure to check out our community at ecommercefuel.com. Work hard, venture often, and I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.